I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Oran Katz. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to talk.
It is. It's going to be a lovely talk. Oran, we're sitting in the PS Art Space in Pakenham Street, Fremantle, and there's an installation all around us where you might say the human dimensions. Not intended to be here, but we are.
Yeah.
And this is all down to you and your collaborators.
Exactly, yeah. This is a work that was actually quite some time in the making. I suppose we can even trace it all the way back to the year 2000, when we grew meat in the lab for the very first time.
Meat in the lab for the very first time. Now, let me immediately tell the people who don't know, and there'll be many who do, will be wanting to hear you talk about this again, that your academic organisation, really, at UWA, Symbiotica, were pioneers in the field of biological arts.
That's correct, yeah. We started, actually, myself and my collaborator in Azure, came up with a crazy idea of using living biological tissues from complex organisms as a medium for artistic expression, and that was way back in 1996. And I suppose one of the main things that drove us to explore this possibility was a work that was revealed in 1995 by a bunch of scientists in Boston of a mouse that had a human ear growing from its back.
Now, who's the man who did that?
His name, actually, there's four of them, Charles and Joseph Acanti, so two brothers, two surgeons, a Chinese plastic surgeon called Yilin Chao, and a material scientist called Robert Langer, who's actually now involved with Moderna vaccine. He was the one who built the lipid membrane for that.
Well, and you finished up in Boston at some point working with some of those guys.
Exactly, we finished up in 2000, actually. The lab where we grew our first piece of meat was the tissue engineering and organ fabrication lab in Harvard Medical School. So in a really weird way, Yonatan and myself were able to find ourselves as research fellows in one of the most prestigious and important labs in the field as artists, but doing the work.
As artists, marrying science and art, biological art, working in labs, working with scientists, working with people who are, in a sense, in every sense, thinking differently. But you didn't start out in this. I mean, I don't know how you could start out in this, but you were in design initially, weren't you?
Exactly, yeah. I studied product design at Curtin. And from the very beginning of my studies, I was really interested in finding ways to marry biology and design. I was really interested in biology, actually. In high school, I specialized in biology. I was debating if I should become an artist, a biologist, or a designer, and then I decided to go and study product design, but figure out ways in which I can combine all of those fields. And what I recognized then, which is very obvious now, is that biology was going through this transformation and becoming more of an engineering pursuit rather than a scientific one. So the attempts was to try and figure out how we can use the knowledge we have in biology to start to engineer living systems. And initially I was quite excited about it. And
does that mean when you say engineering, more technology than science, or is engineering in a different sense?
Yeah, no, more basically treating life as a raw material to extract value from it rather than to learn from. And you can, obviously now there's very little separation between the applied sciences and the fundamental sciences to a large extent, but what we see, especially around biology, that life found ways throughout billions of years of evolution to deal with a lot of the, or solve a lot of the problems that we are facing. And engineers, or biologists who became engineers, are trying to find ways to harness that for human ends and desires. And we, or in my design degree, I was trying to figure out how designers can move in. Because if engineers are moving in to engineer living biological products, in some stage they would call upon designers to work with them. And I started, my honors year was dedicated to this research, but while digging deep into it, I realized there's a flip side, you know. So there's something quite romantic about the notion of changing our culture of manufacturing from building to growing, thinking about the idea of using biological systems that are compatible with the environment rather than artificial or synthetic materials. But the flip side, or there's quite a few flip sides, one of them is, and this is what I ended up really kind of investigating in the last 25 years, is how that's going to change our relationship to the idea of life as a kind of philosophical perspective, which I think is quite important, because if we don't have the tools to be able to scrutinize and analyze this, those shifts in our perceptions of life, we'll find ourselves in a...
Well, particularly when you bear in mind, I've forgotten how many billions there are of we humans on the planet at the moment.
Exactly, so...
Now, you as Symbiotica, soon enough, found your way to UWA, Center of Excellence, doing all of this stuff. And you win awards.
Quite a few,
And and then you finish up amongst the many places you finish up is one of my favorite places, MoMA in New York.
That's correct.
And all sorts of things are happening. But I think one of these was called the Victimless Leather. Is that the one?
That's the one. That's that became our poster kid. And actually, the Victimless Leather was a direct continuation of a project of growing meat in the lab. Just to put that in context, we were able to grow our first piece of meat when we were in Harvard, but we were not allowed to eat it because it was a biomedical research lab and didn't have a license to produce food. So in 2003, we were invited to a show in France. We were able to set up a fully functioning lab in the gallery, grow 5 grams of frog meat, and then at the very last day of the exhibition, share it in this ultimate Nouveau Cuisine dinner where six people, or us and four other people from the audience, were able to at least, we know that this is the first documented, if not the first time, when someone put into their mouth a piece of meat that was grown in a dish rather than in the body of the animal. And then in 2004, we continued that with our Victimless Leather, that then in 2008 was invited to MoMA in New York as part of a very big and a very seminal design show called Design an Elastic Mind.
Well, I've really taken with the New York Times review of the Elastic Minds from 2008. Art is deathless, the poets say, unless it isn't. One of the strangest exhibits at the opening was the very strange show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York that explores the territory where design meets science. Was a teeny coat made out of living mouse stem cells. The Victimless Leather was kept alive in an incubator with nutrients, unsettlingly alive until recently. That is, what happened?
Right, so the Victimless Leather, we showed it in quite a few places around the world, and always there's surprises with it. The idea of that was to create this environment where we could grow a small jacket using cells that were taken from animals. So actually, the original one was a combination of mouse and human cells growing into a leather-like material in the shape of the jacket. In New York, in MoMA, we tried for the very first time to work with embryonic stem cells. We were using mouse embryonic stem cells. We worked with scientists in Columbia University. And something that never happened to us before happened there, where the cells grew so fast and so much of them that they sheared off. The way we do it, we create a polymer scaffold. So we basically create a place for the cells to grow on, and the cells then cover it and dissolve it as they do, and we're basically replacing the polymer scaffold with the living tissue. But in the case of Victimless Leather in MoMA, some of the cells sheared off that structure and started to travel around that closed system that was the life support system, and grew so fast that they clogged the system to such an extent that it had to be turned off.
A Frankenstein.
To a large extent, or Frankenstein's creature, yeah.
Frankenstein's creature.
Don't let me start about Frankenstein, I have a whole.
Well, it is this whole notion of playing God sometimes comes into all of this, doesn't it?
It is an interesting, you know, as an agnostic, I don't really subscribe to the idea of playing God as much, but I do agree with kind of the ancient Greek story of Prometheus, which is actually Frankenstein is the modern Prometheus. This notion of stealing powers from the forces, the powers to be in some way or form, without really understanding the ramification of that. So I totally subscribe to that, and this is one of the issues I have around our push towards using biological technologies to such an extent that we have no idea what the long-term ramification of that, but more to my interest is how that's going to change our relationship to the world around us. So I'll just give you one example. We know that the first industrial revolution, we basically took away sentiency from labor. So by giving labor to machines, to non-sentient machines, we were able to create a lot of our production by kind of those non-sentient entities and taking away that from sentient labor like farm animals, slaves, and workers. Come the what's now being called the fourth industrial revolution, where we see the things like artificial intelligence and artificial life and autonomous systems, where we're starting to give agency and sentiency to human-made machines and technology. At the very same time, we're now trying to remove sentiency from biological labor. So the idea of growing meat without animals, and actually I have just recently one of the people who was really pushing this field gave a TED talk where she talked about sentiency is something which is kind of a surplus that we need to remove when we grow. So she was talking about, yeah, rather than growing a chicken with feathers and beaks and sentiency, we should just grow a piece of meat in the lab. So we are removing sentiency from biological entities and we are giving sentiency to machines. So we know what impact the Industrial Revolution had, the first Industrial Revolution had on human culture and human society. What kind of impact we're going to have when we are going to reverse the roles of sentiency between biological and non-biological entities. So as an artist, I'm interested in those questions rather than providing solutions or promoting some kind of a bright future, because I think if we're not addressing those issues very early in the game, we'll find ourselves in trouble. Yeah.
What's that a photo of?
So that's the Vikingmast ladder. This is the system that we build. So it is an automated system designed after, obviously there's so much history in the life sciences around the notion of trying to grow parts of animals outside of the animals. So there's a guy called Alexis Carrel, who was the Nobel Prize winner of medicine in 1912, who set up a lab in the Rockefeller Institute in New York and started to work with Charles Lindbergh on what they called an organ perfusion pump, where they were trying to grow or to maintain organs alive outside of the body of the animals. It was actually a huge leap towards organ transplant. So we fashioned our system somewhat based on the organ perfusion pump, and then obviously we worked with scientists at UWA that were developing other systems, and we kind of adapted and subverted that system in order to grow this tiny jacket, which you can see in the center there. But it is very much, and the full title of the Vikingmast ladder is a stitchless jacket grown inside the techno-scientific body. So we didn't want to show the end product of that. We're interested in this idea that in order to do those kind of things, you actually have to create a surrogate technological body in which to grow those body parts. So when you think about growing meat in the lab, for example, what you actually do, you basically outsource the function of the body of the animal to technology. You know, you need to provide all of the, you have to provide the oxygen, you have to provide the nutrients, you have to provide the protected environment. So in a sense, you create an artificial technological body in which to grow this meat, or in our case, in which to grow the leather. And this apparatus, the way it's being promoted to us, it's totally invisible. So the idea is that those or the researchers and the companies and promoters of those new solutions are trying to totally obscure what's really involved. Yeah, because they're presenting the lab as this magical place that doesn't use any resources, that you put stem cells on one hand and you get abundance of food or leather or materials without any consequences.
Yeah. Well, this photograph, which our listeners will be able to look at on the Shipping News website as they're listening to this, also has just a lot of sort of stunning beauty about it. As a photograph, it's delightful. It's been very well designed. It's got what you've described happening in the globe in the middle. And some people coming into MoMA to see this know they're going to see something different because it's the Elastic Mind exhibition, but some might just say, oh, well, that's beautiful, I'll move on, it's an installation, installations are interesting. Or is this guy just trying to shock us? Or just what is the message? But you've been telling us what the message is.
Yeah, and it is an interesting case. So We're not shying away from shock. We don't want to be dismissed as only kind of shock artists. That's not our interest. But this idea of shock is an interesting one because it tells us that there's something there that disturbs people that needs to be probed further. So, you know, I'm a staunch believer in gut reaction because it tells you that there's something there that needs probing. The problem I have is that often the case is that people would refer to our work as being shock for shock's sake because they're not willing and they're too afraid to engage with actual issues and probe why they're feeling so shocked about it. And in a sense, this is like shooting the messenger because those kind of things are happening in labs every day, everywhere in the world, and we're not really exposed to them. So by recontextualizing this kind of work and putting it within an artistic context, there's two things that happens. One is that they're being confronted by it in a way that they're rarely being confronted when they're engaged with science, if they are engaged with science. And the second thing is that art and this the amazing art historian from Oxford, Martin Kemp, I was in a conference with him, and he was talking about the fact that art has a function but not a utility. Yeah, so the function of art is to raise awareness, is to challenge your perceptions, but it doesn't have a utility. It's not solving real problems in the world, and that's exactly why it's so powerful, because I can't hide behind utility. I can't say I'm going to feed the world. I can't say I'm going to find a cure for cancer. When we do that, we do it because it's perceived to be frivolous and therefore it requires you to engage with the ethical issues that it's raising without making this cost-benefit analysis of utilitarian ethics. But we are going to, you know, cure cancer. Yeah.
When you take that explanation, mm-hmm. To whom do you get this message through to? Is it the general public? Is it me? Is it policymakers in governments? Is it scientists in the lab? Who is your message in a sense addressed to?
It's a great question because this is something that obviously as a young artist 25 years ago I didn't really, you know, I just wanted to do it. I just wanted to explore it for my own sake because I was so puzzled by the fact that when I started to go into the lab I realized that I have no words to describe the experiences I have, the things I'm encountering. We had to develop our own vocabulary to a large extent. We talk about those tissue constructs as semi-living because they're not fully alive. One of the very first experiences in the lab, for example, it was in the Lion's Eye Institute where they were working on developing artificial cornea, and they had to test the compatibility of the material they're working with the skin that grows over the eye. So they would get half rabbit's heads once a week or twice a week. We were told the rabbits were killed for food, and the heads would then be sent to a brain research institute where they would take the brains out, and our lab would get it in the afternoon, and we would pop the eyes out, put them in antibiotic solution, and put them in the fridge overnight. So, you know, there's nothing more dead than a half rabbit head with no brain. Yeah, that's a piece of dead meat. But more than 24 hours after, we would start to culture the cells from the eyes of those rabbits, and they were alive. So suddenly we realized this level of liveness that we don't really have a language to describe. You know, the cells were alive, but they were not alive in the same way that the rabbit was alive. And obviously the rabbit that we received was, you know, as I said, you couldn't get more dead than being half a head with no brain, but there's still there's liveness there. So we realized that there's the whole new language that we need to engage with. But when it comes to who, then we realized that people are interested. So when we had our first show in Pica in 1998, it was actually a really well-visited show. We got a lot of feedback. People were really interested in what we're doing. When we started to show our work internationally, we generated a lot of interest. And then we realized our work was used in a submission to the European Commission for policymakers and to the American Congress because to a large extent, and we could see it, you know, with the fact that we were the first to grow meat in the lab, first to grow leather in the lab, as almost like a cautionary tale, more than a decade before it actually happened. So artists, and it's often being said that artists are like the canaries in the coal mine. Yeah, we seem somehow to identify things because of kind of the approach that we have in kind of questioning the world around us. Sometimes we can identify, it's not always, but sometimes we can identify things even before they happen, and then it's being used for different purposes. You know, saying the victimless leather, which we show thought is a cautionary tale, in 2018 I was in a big conference that was one of those series of conferences where startup companies are meeting investors in this new field of biofabrication and cellular agriculture, and they made a timeline of this whole field starting with the victimless leather. So in a sense, artists can also be seen as gentrifiers of knowledge.
They can also be the teller of truths that exactly. people don't want to hear.
Yeah, but
what about here?
So just yesterday I was in a conference in Slovenia, which was also defining our field, and I had to remind people, yeah, that because people were complaining that artists are not taking. Are not taken too seriously, and I said, you know, that's the price we pay. You know, being the court gesture, if people would take you seriously, your head would roll. So how do how do you find the balance between telling truth to power and maintaining your head on your shoulders? Is I think one of the balances that we as artists have to engage with.
We're not hip hop, but we are in biological art, which is a form of, I think. And here we are, bringing us back to what we're in the middle of, this installation, Symbiotic as Sunlight, Soil and Shit.
Indeed.
Exhibition. Decycling, I think you've told me.
Yep.
What is going on here? If you walk into this space over the next week or so while the exhibition is still on, as you must, what do you do? What do you see? What is happening? Give us a concise vision of it.
So I think the first reaction of someone who didn't really hear about it, and I've seen it with people coming in, you're confused. So the first thing is like you come into a space. For me, it looks very much like spaces I went to visit when I went to startup companies in San Francisco and New York, where you have like this converted industrial warehouse that becomes like the headquarters of a company. So we have lots of computers and screens, which are where the data center is in our piece. There's a bunch of
beautiful screens with all sorts of things on them.
Exactly.
They're real, are they?
They are real data that comes from the location. That's the work of our collaborator, Steve Barrick.
Does that mean anything?
There's actually, so we talk about it as reams of meaningless data, but actually there's quite a lot of quite useful data for me to monitor what's happening in the show.
So tell us about what's happening in the show.
So we have a series of small hydroponic systems where we're growing some herbs, so basil and...
Not dope,
I don't think we have a license to do that yet here. But actually this is an interesting case because those hydroponic systems are standing for one of the promises of contemporary agriculture, and that's vertical farms. The idea of indoor farming that is now being promoted as an environmental solution to many issues. And I just recently read an article where there's very few things that you can actually grow in hydroponic systems. So leaf plants, you can't grow, you know, large crops, you can't grow corn or maize or wheat or any of those things, but they're still being promoted as if this is the solution for agriculture. They refer to it as soilless food technologies, SFTs.
SFTs, you have to have an acronym.
Yeah, exactly. Just back to, but then in this article they're saying all of those companies are basically doing R&D to the cannabis industry because the only profitable product that, plant that you can grow indoors in a vertical garden is cannabis. But let's not go there now. But we have the...
There are the herbs being grown here hydroponically. Yeah. What happens
soilless.
Then?
Right, so they're soilless and therefore they need nutrients. And we produce the nutrients in a small lab that we have here in the gallery, where we're using a technique called alkaline hydrolysis.
That's this little booth over here, is it?
Yeah, that's the booth over
like
there.
It's like something that the CIA or KGB are
working
in.
It is. We had to insulate it because the smell inside is just horrendous. So we needed to insulate it from the environment. There's a vent that goes all the way up, and none of the people here, because obviously PS is also a residency place, we don't want to make the life of the artist here.
They're only artists, obviously.
Yeah, but we still don't want to make it too unbearable for them. So we are producing the fertilizer from dissolving bodies, basically. So leftovers from a slaughterhouse where we basically dissolve those pieces of meat and bones and hoofs and horns using alkaline, so using caustic soda.
So one level, the breakdown of that matter, is a good sustainability process. You're taking something that might otherwise be thrown in the earth, although it would compost in its own way there. You're using it here to create fertilizer
for the herbs.
What else do you need to make the fertilizer?
So it's interesting enough, I've been working with a soil scientist at UAA, where we realized that what we're getting out of the alkaline hydrolysis cannot be used directly as nutrients for the plants because it can't absorb it. So we need to put it through soil, where the soil bacteria actually converts that leftovers So even though we're talking about the notion that we are trying to look at the idea of growing food without soil, sun or shit, we still use soil in order to make it acceptable for the plants to absorb. We also have a huge compost heap here, where we are growing a piece of meat, basically. So a piece of, we have muscle cells from a mouse growing in a small dish, heated by the breakdown of the organic material in the compost. So that generates heat, and it generates, it's an amazing system. And actually, I've been to a farm down south. I lived there for 2 weeks, where, and every night I would have a shower using water that was heated by a similar system. So it actually, again, it's a fairly sustainable. It takes quite a lot of water to set up, but then in that farm, for example, for about 10 months, you don't need to do anything. You just run water through it, and the heat inside the compost pile is enough to generate hot water for either a shower or, in our case, an incubator. Now, so we have the herbs that we're growing. Once they're grown enough, we're going to put them into a compost heap to top it up. The meat that we're growing, once we have enough of it, we'll never have enough, but once, as a symbolic gesture, we'll put it in the alkaline hydrolysis, and that will generate the fertilizer for the hydroponic system. So we have a closed system that doesn't generate any food or any excess.
It just feeds itself. Demonstrate that something can keep going round and round.
To a large extent, it's not a, you know, a perpetual motion machine. And this is, there's always, we still have to put stuff. And this is kind of the interesting thing. So we nature did a really good job in creating excess. Yeah. So when the first organisms, first autotrophic organisms, the organisms that were able to extract energy from the sun, the best thing they could do for the rest of us was generate so much excess that other organisms can feed on and create a food cycle. Human extractive practices are often in reverse. You know, we deplete resources and we rarely put anything back. The notion of separating our food production from nature claims that they are going to somehow complete the cycle. And the question we're raising with the show is exactly, is that really a sustainable solution? Is the idea of separating humans, and I compared it to the mindset of the tech companies that are now trying to convince us to move to a virtual existence through the metaverse, which is kind of, would bring us into what can be considered to be a nature-free human habitation environment, where we'll be totally unaware of the costs of our existence there. There was research that was done many years ago around Second Life, which was kind of the first version of the metaverse, where they're claiming that the carbon footprint of an avatar in Second Life is an equivalent to a person in Brazil. So even though you live in this virtual natural free environment, feels that you know,
that's what you chew up.
You're still chewing up so much energy, but you're not aware of it. And one of the things we are questioning with this work is what we see now with those promises of sustainable existence through divorce from nature, is really the case, or is it just another layer of obscuring the cost of our existence? You know, and it's not surprising that so many of those companies are using rhetoric like guilt-free consumption. This company is saying, now with our products you can consume more, not less, of what you love, as a way of convincing us that actually this neoliberal project can continue indefinitely through constant growth because we're somehow decoupling our existence from nature, which is never the case.
There's attractions in it, I suppose. If we've got a bunch of those bright year 12 guys and girls around our table here and got them to express their views and what they liked about it and what they didn't like about it, I wonder what we'd get out of them. I suppose, on the one hand, if you're able to bring everything into a very compact space and you were able to grow meat or herbs or cannabis and that made everybody happy, then we would not be tearing up the Amazon, talking about Brazil, or we mightn't be making more Arab, the Australian agricultural regions. Would that be an argument?
That's the argument, but then what you don't realize is that there's still resources that are needed in order to grow it, which are external resources.
Well, take these computers over here.
Exactly.
What's the example with them? They look simple, they don't look much, only partly taking up a wall. Are they consuming energy?
They are consuming so much energy, and they're consuming so much data, you know, because we have a live feed. You know, we didn't calculate the footprint of this exhibition, but it is, you know, It is quite significant, and obviously there's nothing that we are producing here that would offset it in any meaningful way. But, you know, I suppose it's like we heard about the first shipment of hydrogen to Japan from Australia as clean energy, while the hydrogen was actually produced using coal. Yeah. So this idea of creating those layers and layers and layers of technological obstruction in order for us not to be aware of the real costs. I gave this lecture yesterday. I was talking about a paper that was published recently by MIT researchers that are talking about the idea of growing wood in the lab. So not meat, not leather, but growing wood in the lab. And they're talking about, yeah, you know, trees are actually not so good for the environment. We started living alone. You know, this idea of forestry is not really sustainable, which is fair enough. But then they're saying we'll be able to grow the wood without all of these excess things like roots and leaves. Yeah, as if somehow the wood would grow in the lab with no energy or nutrient input. And when you think about it, if we are going on an industrial scale of growing meat or wood or leather in the lab, we would have to have vast amount of crops to produce the raw materials to feed them. As I said, what we are doing with those techniques is outsourcing the function of the bodies of the plants or the animals to technology, but there's still an input that needs to come in. So all of those companies are talking about renewable energy. So when they calculate the footprint of their of their products, they say, yeah, all of the energy we're using would come from renewable energy. Right. So let's get the renewable energy first and then let you calculate it. Because, you know, if we have renewable energy for everything, that would be great news, you know, so you can claim the transport wouldn't.
Well, the lithium has to be dug up out of the earth. It has to be transported. It might be sent by air. It may be sent by ship. What are they using? Interesting questions, aren't they?
Yeah. So we talk about those in terms of metabolic rift technologies. So metabolic rift is a Marxist idea about the fact that capitalism.
I've heard that word for a long time. Marxist.
Yeah, here we are. But you know, it's an updated. I don't necessarily subscribe to everything that Marx says, but this is a really interesting analysis where he already, back in the 19th century, identified the fact that we are separating our means of production from nature and would create an irreparable damage to nature.
There's also a question of alienation of humans, isn't there, from nature?
Exactly, completely. And this idea, you know, this is the other thing that, again, there's a company that is developing meat in the lab. And on their website, they show an image of a cow and say the way we grow our meat at the moment is unnatural and cruel, which is fair enough. Then they show an image of the so-called factory, I don't know how much of it is true, where it's basically, it looks like, I suppose, little creatures or gouge road. It's like huge fermenters, like silver, stainless steel, you know, in a like bright white room.
Like the gin making in the Republic of Fremantle here.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, magnificent.
And then they're saying how we grow meat is natural. As if growing, this is the natural way to grow meat.
So made naturally with these chemicals.
And within those totally artificial environments. So they are trying to sell those, what we refer to as the metabolic rift technologies, as if they are natural solutions, because they're somehow you work with biology, but it's nothing but natural. Yeah, so this.
I wonder if there was meat soon after the Big Bang.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, this is in a sense what's happening.
There's another company, and I showed the video in the conference, where they claim that they're creating meat from air. They call themselves air protein. They went to the World Economic Forum to sell the idea. What they're doing is basically trying to produce proteins using bacteria. So there's a combination, actually, and they do admit in the small print, you realize that they're using huge amount of energy, but it's all renewable, according to them. But they know that if they'll talk about bacterial proteins, people wouldn't like to eat it. So they talk about this idea that they can somehow extract meat from the air. You know, this kind of air business, like, and people subscribe to it. And the issue I have with that is not so much, you know, there might be possible. It's this notion that we can continue with business as usual because those smart scientists, those smart technologies, those Silicon Valley people would find a solution for us, and we can just continue consuming the world around us. And the risk I have, and being involved with this field and going to those conferences and meeting those startup companies, that they are applying the Silicon Valley logic to food production. So we all heard about Elizabeth Holmes.
I think the Silicon Valley principle is called share price.
And fake it till you make it, which is so that even before the share price, you go when those companies are trying to attract venture capitalists, they give them the most fantastical, seductive stories with very little grounding. And actually, sitting in some of those meetings, you know, and actually I turned back to them. I felt as if I'm in a conference around the future of transportation when no one took gravity into account. Yeah, and it's the same. They're basically promising us biological impossibilities. But they're seductive, and well, they're magical.
This is a seductive and magical conversation, I want it to go on forever. But our listeners are probably going to have to go up and pick the kids up, or get along to pickleball, have a swim down at South Beach. But what they'll really be wanting to do is come down here to the Pears Art Space and realise that something quite subversive is in fact going on, as you've not so subtly been explained.
Yeah, although in the show itself, you know, it's up to them to explore it. The language we use is quite ambiguous. It's up to them to make their decisions and engage with those challenges. We're not going to tell them what to think. We're not going to tell them if it's good or bad. Obviously, when I talk to you, I give myself the freedom to be less ambiguous about it. But we really want people to think about it for themselves.
It's fabulous. As everyone knows, it's a great space here. We're very lucky, unfortunate for you, that your initial plans of doing this in Tasmania were thwarted by the WA rules and getting out and getting in. But here we are. Installations are always great things. You want to know what this is all about. Come down and enjoy it. And it's on until the
26th, so a week from today, or from tomorrow.
Yeah. And you just get in, come down, particularly the weekend.
And I'll be here most of the time, so if people want to come and have a chat, very keen.
And do talk to Oran. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.